The following address, entitled Developing a Plan for Outreach, was delivered by Reverend Bill Buchestein at the United Reformed Church's Missions Conference, held at Mid-America Reformed Seminary in June 2013. The views expressed by the speaker are his own and are not necessarily endorsed by Mid-America Reformed Seminary, its faculty, or its Board of Trustees.
Earlier, I know paybacks can be rough, and I'm just anticipating after about 20 minutes Mike saying, oh, that's enough, that's it. I think it might actually be all right, though. I can cut back some of my material. Reverend Murphy covered a lot of where I was going to go, some at what, which I guess is bound to happen when a pastor asks for permission to keep going and doesn't wait for people to say yes and just keeps going. So you covered some of my stuff, but I think it'll be all right. I'm going to read just a few verses from Acts chapter 19. Verses 21 and 22. And this is in the context of Paul's ministry in Ephesus. And I want to focus on a phrase from the second, from the first line or second phrase of the verse 21, purposed in the Spirit. But Luke writes this, when these things were accomplished, Paul purposed in the Spirit when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. So he sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, but he himself stayed in Asia for a time. So I'm going to be speaking at this time on developing a plan for congregational outreach. And thank you. And it seems to me that almost every church has a desire to reach out to the lost. I mean, you'd hardly find a church which would say, we don't have a desire to reach out to the lost. We don't have a desire to be known in our community. So almost no churches would take that view, but I wonder how many churches actually have a plan to reach out to the community, actually have thought through it and have articulated these things. And my contention is that effective congregational outreach is best facilitated by a thoughtful and written game plan, so to speak. And so my goal tonight is to, first of all, defend the need for a plan, or if need is too strong, at least the advantages of a plan for outreach. Secondly, to identify some possible elements of a plan. And then third, to work through the implementation of a plan. And this talk flows out of some work that we've done as a consistory. I presented something like this to our consistory, and we wrestled through it and worked this out with the congregation as well. And we've actually found it to be quite helpful. And so maybe something like this will be helpful for you all as well. Before I begin, I just want to make a distinction between evangelism and outreach. So Pastor Murphy talked about the pastor as evangelist and the evangelist as a pastor. And I think it's helpful to distinguish outreach from evangelism. And I'll mention why in just a moment. But I think we would probably all agree that evangelism should be understood as the plain and direct communication of the gospel to the unconverted. Outreach, I would understand as a broader concept, a broader activity in which the church, in meaningful ways, makes itself known to its community in order to make inroads to communicate the gospel. So it's different than evangelism. It's a means to evangelism. It's making itself known to its community in meaningful ways in order to make inroads, in order for people to be aware of the ministry, and to be, by the grace of God, drawn into the church, to be blessed by it. And I was encouraged in this regard with a conversation with Dr. Carl Truman a few weeks ago, where he explained something that they did as a church. He's been pastoring for a little while now in a church in Philadelphia, and they did a C.S. Lewis dramatic reading in a park. And so they promoted this, they prepared materials for it, they had materials that talked about some of the religious concepts, at least, in Lewis's works. And then people came to the park, and Dr. Truman just sat in a rocking chair and read the Chronicles, or read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which, by the way, which reminds me of a huge advantage that British people have ministering in America. I mean, you know, if I were to sit in a rocking chair and read C.S. Lewis, nobody would care. But, you know, Dr. Truman sits in a rocking chair and reads the book, and I'm sure people are spellbound. It's just unfair advantage. But so you know, a lot of people came out. People ended up coming to church through this, but inevitably there were some complaints and concerns, and people said, well, that's not evangelism. You know, you're just reading C.S. Lewis. It's not evangelism. And, you know, Dr. Truman said, it's not evangelism. You know, that's the point. So he's tried to distinguish in his church as well the difference between outreach and evangelism. And he would have identified this as outreach, not evangelism. So I think that's an important distinction. I'll try to focus on outreach, although there is some overlap as well. Just want to acknowledge also that perhaps not everyone will agree with my view of how the church, as church, should engage in outreach. So we might disagree on that. Some might see the function of a church in a more narrow way. But the position I'm going to take is that the church should not only equip believers for outreach, but should also mobilize believers for outreach, provide opportunities for outreach, provide context, provide occasions for outreach as well. So that's the position I'm going to take, and you might modify that in your local setting. But so one other last point before we look at the need or the advantages of congregational outreach is that outreach, as I understand it, is definitely not an end in itself. So it's a means of introducing people who are outside of the church to what's happening inside of the church. Our goal, of course, is to minister to the people that God would send to us by the means of grace, and pray that God would bless those. So all of these things, it's outreach, because we're reaching out to those who aren't coming to church, prayerfully expecting them to come so that they can be blessed by the means of grace. So I want to first of all just reflect a little bit on the need or advantages for a plan for outreach. And I want to first look at a couple of reasons or interact with a few reasons why we might not have plans for a congregational outreach, have not developed plans. And I think one of them is, and this has been touched on a little bit already, is a tendency to reactionism. And I think part of this I want to acknowledge in a very positive way. This is actually part of the thread of, or part of the fabric of our identity, actually. And we want to positively acknowledge those who several years ago reacted courageously against some very disturbing trends in the previous denomination. So there's certainly a time for reaction, and that was good. What can happen, though, is that can sort of set the pace, and we could sort of follow along that positive reaction to liberalism or whatever else. And that becomes kind of who we are. We're reactionists. We sort of wait for things to fall into our laps or for things to go bad, and then we respond to them. We wait for deacons to come and say, we're broke as a family, instead of being proactive and engage them in certain terms of education and things like that. And my contention is that we must not become reactionistic. I think J.I. Packer defines sectarianism as that attitude which defines itself by what someone isn't. And, you know, we need to avoid that. We need to be the people who do, not just the people who don't do this, that, and the other thing. We need to be proactive, and I'll argue visionary in, I think, a biblically bounded way. I think this idea of reactionism also contradicts the thrust of the Great Commission. You know, we heard already, going, making disciples and going, and you know, it's not waiting. It's not sitting there waiting for others to hear about what we're doing. And so we want to be careful that we don't fall into a tendency to reactionism. And I want to touch on another reason why we might not have a plan for outreach in our congregations is we might be under the assumption that our doctrine is our plan. And I think that's not true. I think it's not accurate. You know, we might look at the confessions and say, you know, that's our plan. After all, the confessions tell us what the church is. It tells us, at least in brief fashion, what the church should do. And we say, well, there's our plan. That's how we're going to do outreach. But I think there's a huge difference between a theological basis for a plan, which the confessions clearly are, and the plan itself. Timothy Keller has suggested that we need to use our doctrine to answer specific questions about outreach, which will help us formulate what he calls a theological vision. And I don't think you have to agree with Keller's particular theological vision to understand the logic. So let me just explain this. Two churches, for example, say in our federation, with identical theological positions, could do outreach in two very different ways. Right? Two churches with identical theologies could give very different answers in terms of how they think about their culture, in terms of how they interact in their city, in terms of how they view the relationship between word and deed ministries. So you've got the same theology, but your plan is different, the way you're implementing and using those theological structures. So the three forms of unity, for example, they don't tell us how progressive or traditional our churches will feel. Right? They just don't do that. They don't tell us how a city church will do ministry different than a rural church will. And we trust and we would recognize that they would do ministry differently. So they're sort of taking the same starting point, but they're sort of creating two different theological visions. You can use different phrase than that if it sounds strange to talk about vision. But we need to not say that our theology is our plan for outreach. It certainly informs us and helps us. But I think a way that we could look at this is having no outreach plan and expecting to do outreach is sort of like expecting to lose weight without a diet plan, right? I mean, you could have all of your dietary dogma perfect. You know, you could understand nutrition. You could understand how weight loss and weight gain happens. You could have it all in order. But if you don't have a plan for how you're going to lose weight, it's probably not going to happen, or it's going to be very haphazard. Or you can maybe take another example of a military interaction. You could be a military strategist and military theorist. You could understand how armies work. You could understand the history of war. But you would not send an army into battle without a plan. At least you shouldn't. Better not comment on that. But you should be careful sending an army somewhere without a plan for how this is actually going to work out. So we need to be aware of the need for a plan. Let me also move then to a biblical defense for outreach planning. And this is where I want to refer back to Acts chapter 19. And specifically in verse 21, Luke uses a phrase to describe one example of Paul's vision for ministry. And that is when he writes this, "When these things were accomplished, Paul purposed in the Spirit." He purposed in the Spirit. And other translations, ESV, for example, says that he resolved in the Spirit. The Greek word tithemi means to put down. I mean, literally putting something down, determining something that you can identify. He strategized. I mean, you can see from the text here, he's laying out a plan. He's strategizing in terms of how he's going to go about in his ministry. Matthew Henry comments on this, I think, very helpfully. He says, "Paul was a man of vast designs for God." A man of vast designs, of plans, of strategies. And Henry goes on to say, "and was making his influences as widely diffusive as might be." So he's planning, he's purposing. And what's happening in this text is that one phase of Paul's ministry in Ephesus had been completed, and so he's building on that. And he's doing so, as you'll notice from the context, in very concrete terms. He does this. He says, he purposed in the Spirit that when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia to go to Jerusalem, saying, "After I've been there, I must also see Rome." I think it's interesting that his plan is not vague, like our plans might sometimes be. I mean, probably all of us would have the plan to have the church grow. I mean, that would be our vision, our goal, to have the church expand. But that's not really a plan, is it? It's a goal, but it doesn't actually say how we're going to get there. And Paul strategized, he planned. And It's also interesting that he doesn't just strategize. He actually puts his plan into action. Verse 22. So, in other words, because of the plan, the purpose, the strategy, so he sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus. But he himself stayed in Asia for a time. So a spiritual purpose requires action. And we could look at other examples from Scripture, even God himself. You know, the covenant of peace is at least a general framework, recognizing that God is a planner. And, of course, great differences between how we plan and how God does. But all of this to say that it seems to me that this planning means that as a congregation, certainly under the leadership of the minister and elders and deacons, we should be prayerfully brainstorming. Prayerfully brainstorming for ways that we can glorify God better as a church. Not waiting, not being passive, but prayerfully brainstorming about new possibilities. We then, it seems to me, should develop these ideas into a plan which can give us a sense of direction and cohesion in our efforts. I mean, there's probably not a church here that doesn't engage in some kind of outreach. But I think the question is, are those efforts cohesive? Are they working together? Are they pursuing a common direction? And then finally, of course, we need to implement some of those ideas. We don't want to just be strategists. We don't want to just be planners. We need to be implementing those ideas. So we need to, it seems to me, be spiritual planners, especially when it comes to outreach. I think that at the heart of our plan is Paul's great goal, of course, to have the church grow. Right? Our plan is not divorced from the church. We want to see the church grow. God is glorified when the church grows. And I think there's a very simple formula for church growth. And I'm not going to write a book about it because it's so simple. It'd be silly. The church grows when visitors become members, right? I mean, aside from biological growth, that's how the church grows. You've got a visitor, comes to the church, and becomes a member. And so I think with that very just simple framework, we should be praying for visitors. We should be engaging means that would draw visitors to the church. We should be receiving them warmly and hospitably. We should be discipling them and, with God's help, leading them to confess faith in Christ and join the church. And so that's how I'm going to approach the elements of a plan. The elements of the plan have to have as its goal seeing sinners come into the church. All right, so it's not divorced from the church. And so that's where I'm going to go secondly, looking at some elements of a plan. And what I hope to do here is to do two main things, although I'm going to have a number of sub-points. First of all, I want to build a framework, a sort of a structure. And this will be based on what our congregational outreach plan looks like. And I want to do that because, although I'm going to secondly look at some specifics, our specifics might be different than your specifics. Some of the things that we do at Covenant Reformed Church in Carbondale would just be not effective, not even probably worth pursuing in some of your churches. But I do want to look at some specifics because this is sort of a brainstorming session in a sense. You know, I'm going to try to throw out a lot of ideas, and you might reject 50% of them or 75% of them, but hopefully something will help spark some ideas or plug into your thinking about church outreach. So laying out a basic structure and then filling in that structure with a few ideas. And I want to progress through these elements of the plan with that same logic that we've just outlined a moment ago, that church growth happens when visitors become members. All right, so I want to start at the sort of pre-visitor phase. And that would be inviting people to church. And, of course, that's really what we're all about in terms of our outreach, right? That's why we issue a call to worship every Lord's Day. It's a reminder that God is actually calling people to come and worship Him in the church. So it's really an invitation / command by God every Lord's Day. And this should propel us to say, look, I want my neighbors to be hearing this call to worship every Lord's Day. And so I'm going to invite them to come to church so that they can hear God's call. And so I just want to reflect a little bit on inviting people to church. A few sub-points here under that. First of all, of course, face-to-face is still best way of inviting people to church. And as Reverend Murphy mentioned, that more people come to church because they're invited by a friend than by any other reason. And so that's something we want to be putting before our people. Like, we might all know that. You know, we heard some statistics about that. But if we're not communicating that to our people, they might assume that they're not really a part of outreach. You know, it's all about our advertising, or it's all about our, you know, the professional level outreach. But we actually need to encourage them and say, hey, you're the main reason, humanly speaking, that people are going to come and hear God's gospel. And so, of course, this is something that the minister should be doing as well. So just some ideas. Pastor could consider laboring throughout the week in a public place. I know some of you brothers do this already. You do your sermon prep sometimes in a coffee shop or a cafe. We've actually in our church made little signs that we put on our table just saying, if you'd like to, you know, want to talk about anything, you know, here we are. Something like that. Can't remember what it says. But, you know, just to be in a public place so that we can invite people to worship, you know. And so that's one idea. We also want to help congregants invite people to worship. You know, sometimes our own folks are sort of embarrassed of our way of doing church. You know, we have a higher liturgy perhaps than some of the churches around them. We don't have the same kind of music that other people might expect. So some of our folks might actually be embarrassed to invite people to church. We need to remind them that God uses the means of word and sacrament and His Spirit, regardless of what the structure looks like. And we actually think it's a biblical structure. And so we want to encourage them not to be embarrassed or anxious about inviting people to church. Another thing that we've really tried to work on as a congregation is capitalizing on the hard work that other people put in to draw non-church people together in one place. And by that I mean probably every one of your towns has some kind of city celebration. So in Carbondale, it's called Ethnic Festival. So very all-inclusive. It's just Ethnic Festival. So I guess everybody's invited. But they put a ton of work into promoting this thing. They've got food. They've got music. And tons of people just collapse into Carbondale in August. And we just want to be there. You know, we don't want to be hosting carnivals at our church. It'd be silly. It'd be expensive. It's confusing to people. But if somebody else is going to organize a carnival and we can go for free and set up a media table and have some people from our church there just engaging the community, why would we not do that? So the way that we've approached that, let me just reflect on this a little bit, is so we just take a little card table, put some of our resources on it. We've actually chosen to focus mostly on video resources. We video record all of our services and just take a sermon every once in a while and package it with a nice cover so it looks hopefully somewhat professional. And just spread them on the table and people come by. And we think that people are probably more likely to take something they can watch than something that they're going to have to read. And we can say that's a shame or they shouldn't be that way or whatever, but I think it is the way it is. And so we have these resources out there, and then usually myself, almost always myself, or maybe a few elders will just be by the table, and we'll ask people from our church to come as well. They sign up for certain slots, and we don't put any pressure on them, you know, the people from the congregation. We just say, why don't you just come with us? And we'll have a good time ourselves just talking to each other, enjoying some time together. But then when people come to the table out of curiosity, you know, the folks from our congregation can hear me interact with these people, the unchurched folks, see their elders doing the same thing. Sometimes they're very comfortable as well. So it's one way to invite people to church is by capitalizing on events organized and paid for by other people. In this connection also, I just want to mention the use of surveys. And this maybe overlaps a little bit with what Reverend Murphy was talking about, but a lot of times what we'll do is we'll take some clipboards with spiritual, we call them spiritual state surveys. And I know there's a lot of kind of opinions on surveys, but the way we approach this is, you know, we'll go up to somebody and say, we're genuinely curious and interested to know what your take is on spiritual things. And you might be hearing that and say, well, that sounds like a bait and switch, because really all you want to do is invite them to church. And I think we need to be careful of that. But the reality is, I think we need to know what their views are on spiritual things. So I think we can say that to them sincerely. Would you mind answering just a few simple questions to help me understand the religious convictions of this community? Because we care about this community. And so we'll start out with a question like, what is your religious background? And almost no one's going to balk at that. You know, it's not an intimidating question. Everybody has some kind of religious background. And then the second question that we ask is, are you currently finding meaning in your religion? And that's kind of interesting, because some people will say, here's my religious background, and no, I'm not finding religious meaning. And you're sort of almost beginning a dialogue about deep spiritual things, even though it's really just a survey. Interestingly, the next question we ask is, what's one thing that you would change about your spiritual life if you could? And it's interesting, because a lot of times the people who say, I'm not finding meaning in my religious life, say there's nothing I would change if I could change one thing. It's just confusing, but it helps us. It's just a way of engaging. And at the end of the survey, we can say, you know, would you like more information about the church? And if they say no, we'll say thank you so much for helping. We don't want it to be a bait and switch. But surveys, we found them to be helpful. Actually, just as an encouragement, we did an event at a local city celebration a few weeks ago. It was actually just myself and my kids and maybe one or two other people from church. And I think about 80% of the people very happily walked through the survey with us. I mean, almost nobody said, no, I'm not interested. And so I think we're intimidated sometimes needlessly. You know, we think people don't want to talk about deep things or spiritual things, but I think we're mistaken in that. I'll just touch on something else I just mentioned as well. As Brother Murphy mentioned, we are trying to cultivate a community or an ethos of outreach in our congregation. And so I'll almost always take my kids along. We want them to grow up thinking this is normal, you know, to go with dad to meet with unbelievers and talk to them about their church or to share the gospel with them, which happens quite often with that survey. And my parents, very, very godly, tremendously godly. But I'm not sure that I ever saw my father communicating the gospel as a child. And perhaps he did, maybe I just didn't remember, but it certainly wasn't part of the fabric of our family life. And we want that to be part of the fabric of our kids' family life. They just think this is normal. We're going out canvassing. We're going out to talk to unbelievers. And they won't balk at it if you start young. So inviting people to church face-to-face is still best. Let me touch briefly on advertising in the church. And I want to read Psalm 66:5 because I think it's actually a demand for advertising. From Psalm 66:5. Psalm 66:5 says, come and see the works of God. And really, that's what our advertising is, right? We're communicating to an unbelieving community using the words of Psalm 66:5 saying, come and see the works of God. We want you to see this. We want you to hear about his works. We want you to hear about the Lord Jesus Christ. Come and see. And so that's really, I mean, sometimes advertising gets a bad rap. It sounds unspiritual somehow. But it's really just, I think, a fulfillment of saying we want others to see what God is doing. We don't want to be the best kept secret in our city. We don't want to be a secret at all. So a little bit on advertising. Just piggybacking a little bit on what Dr. Murray talked about the other day, that social media, Facebook, for example, Google Ads, sort of targeted advertising tends to be sometimes more effective than just generic blanket advertising. You can focus on, you know, regions right around your church, certain demographics. I think what the brothers who've done a lot of this would agree with is that you have to use a lot of experimenting. I mean, I think, Brian, you've done a fair bit of experimenting, different catchphrases, different images perhaps, and sometimes something doesn't work, and sometimes you try something and you get a whole bunch of responses. So experiment, try different things. Let me also mention here some general local advertising, just sort of signage, physical advertising. I'm convinced that it's important to develop some kind of a sort of a brand identity for the church with a logo. And again, that might sound like marketing techniques and slippery salesmanship, but you know, this is just the world we live in. And people want to know that you've thought about your business. Now, we know that we're not a business like every other business is, but you see slipshod, you know, logos on different businesses, and you say that the business hasn't really taken themselves very seriously, hasn't really worked through this. And so what we want to do is, you know, we've paid for an artist to develop a logo for us, and we just want people in our community to see that olive branch logo and think Covenant Reformed, and hopefully that will also generate some other positive thoughts as we try to get out in the community. So just one encouragement, just be sure not to go cheap on this. You know, sometimes we You know, one idea that was floated in our council when I proposed the idea of doing a logo is, you know, why don't we just have all the Sunday school kids, present their best samples, and we'll just have a vote as a congregation, and whichever Sunday school kid had the best artwork, that'll be our logo. It's like, no. You know, I mean, we just, like, that would, of course, defeat the purpose. We want to present that we put thought and energy into our mission. And so, you know, our communities are filled with market-driven people. And there's no way around that. And they want to know that you've thought about what you're doing. And probably that's more important in some areas than others, maybe more urbanized areas it's more important. But just about signs, I think signs obviously need to be well-maintained, need to be lighted, need to be fresh in appearance. And you're probably not going to know if that's the case because you've gone by your church sign 10,000 times. And so what we a lot of times do is if we have a visitor come to our church, well, and if I don't think this would freak them out, I say to them afterwards, could you tell me a few things you noticed about our church? Some positive things, perhaps some negative things, but we don't have fresh eyes anymore. You know, we've looked at this sign 1,000 times. We've looked at our building. We've looked at our liturgy. We can't see it with your freshness. And it's been very, very helpful, actually. One time my brother was visiting not long after we moved there, and the church is built in such a way that the two most obvious doors that a visitor would go through are up a main flight of stairs, and they both open up, and that's where people would go. But none of us use that door. We use kind of a door that you almost have to slink down through in the downstairs area. And apparently when we first got there, those two upper doors, we just kept locked on the Lord's Day. You know, like everybody knows, of course, that you use that side door, so why even keep those other doors open? And my brother just kind of rattled me and said, you guys keep your main doors locked during worship? And so we didn't notice that, but he noticed it, and he helped us out with that. So actually what we've done lately, especially in the summer, we actually just leave the doors totally open. And so we're right on the street. And I wasn't preaching this past Lord's Day at our church, but we did go to church, and we left during the service. And we left, and my wife said to me, when we were leaving, it was really wonderful to be walking down the sidewalk to get to our car and hearing the gospel being communicated on the street. You know, you could hear the songs coming out of the doors, and just we just want to be part of the community. And so maybe that's possible for you as well. I think in terms of signs, many churches probably have too much information, probably old signs just cluttered with stuff, and maybe you've got a verse on your sign with that you could move around with different print, different letters, but it never gets moved and it's just cluttering. It looks old, and so you might want to rethink that a bit. We've also thought of, and what we've done is we've purchased a bunch of, I don't know what the right name is, sort of like campaign ad signs.
Lawn signs.
Lawn signs, thank you. So with our logo and just some basic information, and they're just so inexpensive, you can stick them different places, and if somebody steals them because they don't like them or throws them away or whatever, it's not a big loss. But we just want to sort of respectfully sort of inundate people with our concept, our image. So, so that's inviting people to church. Let me think about. Let's think together. Secondly, about what we've called recycling the preached word. And really, this is born out of two principles. One is Dr. Beakey's principle of never doing something that you're only going to use once if you can help it. So we want to take the preached word that we've put a lot of work into in our studies and sort of stretch it and scatter it as broadly as we can. I know most of us are already doing this in one way or another. That's one principle. The other principle is that this is sort of advertising, but it's like advertising plus, because it's also an edifying word. You're getting the word out. It's also letting people know about the church. So I'll just touch on a few things. First of all, digital media. Some of us have things that we definitely need to be doing that we're not doing because they're free and they're easy, like putting your sermons on public access TV channels. I know that it's not free everywhere, but in Carbondale, or in Scranton rather, it's just free. So we send them a DVD of our service every week, so it costs whatever the DVD costs, and they run our services. And so that's free and pretty easy. We make CDs and DVDs to place in local restaurants, gas stations, in little displays, keep those fresh. We try to utilize social networking. We want to encourage our folks. So again, bringing the congregation into outreach. So one of the things we do is we take little short clips from some of the sermons and upload those onto our YouTube page, YouTube channel. And then we encourage our folks to share those. And so what this does is it allows some of their friends to hear someone from our church saying, hey, this was an encouraging word you might be interested in. And then they can share it with others. And it's just easy. It's inexpensive. So make your audio sermons available and make them shareable. Find out how shareable they are digitally. Is it going to be easy for someone to share your sermons, or do they have to go through a whole rigmarole to make that happen? So just think in terms of taking the preached word and stretching it. How can you scatter that without having to do a lot of extra work? Another way that we can do that is, I think, through outside speaking events. You can host events as a church or accept invitations to events that other churches have organized to help increase exposure. This has been fruitful in our congregation. One of the men that's, Lord willing, going to become a deacon quite soon was at one of the conferences that we organized. We did one on John Calvin and other, a couple other themes, and just came to that, and he said, wow, that's, you know, he heard my preaching, and we just, a couple months later, came in and checked us out, and he's still with us. That's been very encouraging. And we've done some outdoor worship services, not because we feel like we have to be outdoors in the park, because it's something that we're looking for. It's just that that's where people are. And so we had one service where we just moved our service into the local park where people are, and some people from the park came and listened to the gospel communicated. So that's another idea. Let me also touch on a writing ministry in terms of stretching your preaching. One of the things we do as a church is we once a month take one of my sermons and I edit it down into an article format, about 1,400 words, and distribute that in a mailing that we send out to about 600 homes locally called Proclamation. Just give a name to it. And we have that same artist provides a little illustration for it each time to show that we've tried to take it seriously in terms of appearance and so forth. And yeah, it's very inexpensive. It also keeps these folks sort of keeps us on their radar screens. You know, but it's different than us bombarding them with advertisements about the church. We're sending them discipleship material. They can say they don't want it and take it off, but we feel comfortable doing it because we're actually sending them something useful. We're not just sending them flyers about upcoming events. Also, just encourage, that wasn't a cutoff, was it? I saw your hand flinch. So it's like at an auction, a little finger moves and you just bid on something. So, okay. Just want to encourage also competent writers, even beyond the pastor, to contribute to the local newspapers. If you've read your local newspaper lately, you know they're dying for material. And if you can supply something that's edifying, either yourself or competent writers in the congregation, I'm invited to share in a column that our ministerium contributes to called Faith Matters. And when we do that, we try to be positive as possible. I mean, of course, it's hard because, you know, there's so many things that you could write critically, either about the community or about the other ministers writing the columns in the circuit that you're on. But you can address problems, critique them, but contribute toward a solution. You know, we don't want to. You've all read sort of letters to the editor where they're just some angry church person ranting, and that's actually the opposite of what we're trying to communicate. So that's how we would sort of recycle the preached word by way of a writing ministry. I try to always accept invitations to school chapels in the area. And I think a lot of the ministers that come to these school chapels don't put a lot of thought into it. And the kids notice that. The teachers notice that. So I try to just make myself available as much as possible. We've also taken we try to take a lot of some of our studies, like our midweek studies, and do them in public places. I lead a men's group for a sort of a local emergent church. It's kind of a strange arrangement, but we do this in a coffee shop. And so every other Wednesday, we're studying through either Howell Jones on Hebrews we used, or R.C. Sproul on Romans. But it's in the coffee shop, and so that almost every month there's somebody that comes along and sees that we're studying the Bible and says, "Can we sit in and join you?" And it's been good. So try to take that as public as you can. Let me just also touch on another element that is diaconal work in terms of being an outreaching congregation. And let me just read through some of the things that we do. But we think that if your deacons are not on board, your outreach is going to be impoverished. If they're not excited about doing outreach, you've just got a really important part that's just missing. And so we want to encourage our deacons to be involved in outreach. And sometimes you might have to help the deacons. Maybe this isn't true in big churches, but in smaller churches, our deacons really just don't have much of an infrastructure. They don't have, like, the decisions they make seem to almost be like on a gut level. And so by providing them, you know, some forms or some way that they can respond to inquiries just to help them so they don't feel like they're drowning in requests and not knowing how to handle them, that can be really helpful. Also want to make sure that we're not overburdening the deacons. We want to teach them, as our church order says, to supervise works of mercy. We don't want to be lumping everything on the deacons, or they'll certainly not be on board if they feel like, oh, here's another outreach idea. It means we've got more work that we've got to do. It's just we want to help them to supervise. Another way of using the deacons in outreach, and I'm not sure this is the best phrase for it, but maybe you can come up with a better title, sort of community assistance and development. Probably not a good title. But just sort of noticing things in the community that the deacons can help us to help the community with. One of the things we do here is a clothing drive twice a year, spring and in the fall. We call it the Open Closet. And throughout the months preceding this, we're collecting clothing donations from the congregation. And since it's been like the fourth or fifth year now, we get a lot of donations from the community. And the deacons oversee this, but they don't do all the work. And so twice a year, we've got just a flood of people from the community coming in and getting as much clothes as they need for free. And so that's sort of that brand identity. They're walking into our church. They're seeing our sign. They're connecting that with, these people care about me. And they're providing me with clothing. They're not just saying, we care about our community. You know, we're trying to show that. You know, find something broken in the city and fix it as a church. And you might disagree with whether that's church work or not, but what we did a couple years ago is we targeted one of the parks in our community, and real beat up park, real broken down. A lot of the benches were broken down. And we just took two Saturdays, just a couple hours in the morning. We just replaced the planks on the benches. We painted them up. But before we did that, we sort of canvassed the community around the park and said, you know, on this date, we're going to be fixing up your park, basically. And it'd be great if you could come and join us. It'd be a fun day. We'll have a lunch afterwards. And one of the ladies that, actually an old, quite an older lady, a grandmother, she came out and helped us. And she's still a member in our church. And we didn't know her at all. But she cared about the park, and she cared that we were fixing the park. And she came and worshipped with us, and she's a member with us still. So another category, you can fill in the blanks, but you could think about community education or community training. Maybe there's someone in your church who could sort of do an after-school tutoring program. Just open up the church, and maybe a former educator would be able to come, and you could just advertise in the community. You know, free tutoring or free reading class, or maybe you could publicize your counseling ministry. You know, we all counsel. We've been trained to counsel. Maybe you could publicize that, and maybe there's people in your church who could help you that you wouldn't have to do all of it. But you're providing education and training for the community, something that they already see as valuable, even though they don't know that the reason we think it's valuable is because God is the only one that can solve all our problems. And so, you know, another idea that we're kind of working on, hopefully for this summer, at least thinking about, is hosting a job search seminar. It's not evangelism; it's outreach, but. There's so many people in our community, at least, that would have no clue how to get a job. I was in a gas station one time in Carbondale, and saw a guy go up to the manager and say, you know, I'm looking for a job. Do you have an application I can fill out? And in my head, I'm thinking, nope, you're not getting that job, because he's got sweatpants on. You know, he looks like he just rolled out of bed. He just had no clue about how to get a job. And, you know, so we've got guys in our church that could lead the way with this, provide helps with making cover letters, resumes, interviews, things like that. Just trying to be involved in the community. Find opportunities. Maybe you could find chaplaincy opportunities in local YMCA or a hospital or larger business, maybe. So let me move to making a good impression. So we've talked about inviting people to church. Now we're hopeful that people will come to church. We've got to be mindful of the impression that we make on them as a church. We don't want to invite them to something that, and then not think about what they're actually coming to. And I know Reverend Murphy touched on this a little bit, but let me actually first of all touch on our website, because actually the website is becoming the new first impression for most people. Almost nobody today will come to your church without having first gone to your website. And for some of you, that should be frightening. Because some of the websites in the Federation are just not making a good impression. You know, they're outdated, they are just, they're poor. And so we can't be cheap on this either. Even though it's not expensive, if you don't have someone in the church that can do it, you just got to pay someone to do it. You know, if your church developed a website 10 years ago, and that's the one you're still using, it's probably no good. You know, if you did it 4 years ago and it's still the one you're using, it may be no good. So this is the new first impression. And somebody sees a website that's crummy, and they're just going to say, this church hasn't thought about what they're doing. This is a crummy old church somewhere. And we would say, but that's not what you should be thinking about. You know, you should be thinking about our church in terms of its doctrine or in terms of its, but it's not what they're thinking about, you know. So make sure the website makes a good impression. Make sure it's updated frequently. Don't put stuff on your website if it's going to become outdated and you're not going to change it. Just don't put it on. Make sure that everything works. Make sure that your email link works, your maps, and make sure all that stuff works. Also, something we're actually still wrestling with, but make sure that your website is current technologically. Make sure that it's like mobile friendly, for example. I mean, I think most sermons that people listen to today, they're not sitting in front of their computer listening to sermons that they've downloaded from your website. That's probably something from, you know, from a mobile device. So make sure that your website is web friendly. Let me then move to facilities in terms of making good impression. The facility is sort of the second first impression that visitors are going to be confronted with. And we need to think about this. The building should be evaluated frequently with the input of outsiders, if possible. And definitely with the input of women, if possible. Because you get a group of men together, say the council or the consistory, and you go out in front of the church and you say, what kind of impression does this make? The men will say, what kind of a stupid question is that? Who cares? The rain isn't coming in. You know, the windows are all fixed up. And, you know, men don't think about the aesthetics as often sometimes as women do. And so just having women just help evaluate the appearance of the building. You know, is it presentable? Does a woman feel comfortable, you know, going into the church? Last summer we planted a whole row of flowering trees in front of the church. Trying to make a more positive impression as people come in. And actually, just as a side note, what we did with that is we made it a community event. So we could have just planted four trees in front of our church, but we thought, why not just do the whole block? And so we contacted all the neighbors and said, we're going to buy trees for you and plant them in front of your house. Would you like to come and help us do that? And we'll have a lunch afterwards and some stories with that. One lady was really mad that we were only going to put one tree in front of her house. And I just couldn't process that. But most of the neighbors were very, very happy about it. They didn't feel shorted. So are the facilities clean? Especially the bathrooms, the children's areas, are they clean? Are they beautiful? Again, ask the women about that. Are the facilities accessible? Is your parking a problem? If parking is a problem, you may need valets. You know, you may need to think about creative ways to make parking as least problematic as possible. Does your building provide helpful information about the church? Is your book table well-stocked? Is your book table presentable? Or is it on some old rickety turnstile or something that's been in the church since 1975? I mean, these are things that we look at them and we say, it works. But someone else walks in and says, it's embarrassing, it's ugly. Then I think moving to hospitality. And this is just huge. And it's been touched on a bit, so I don't go into detail. But I think believers today grossly misunderstand hospitality. I think we look at hospitality as something that happens when I go to my parents' house and they serve me a meal, I'll leave and say, thanks for your hospitality. It's just, that's not even it, is it? You know, hospitality in the Bible is love of strangers. And we need to really press that with our folks. You know, having professional greeters. I don't know, just think about this. I could be wrong, but just think about having professional greeters with name tags on, kind of going through their motions. I'm not sure it's hospitality. I think we can do better than that. I think we can encourage people who really have a heart to love strangers, to greet strangers. And we've actually determined that the best physical location for greeters is not in the narthex. Because that's not where visitors are scared to death. They've already overcome their fear if they're in the narthex. We put our greeters on the sidewalk because that's where people are thinking, am I actually going to go into this church or not? And we found that to be extremely valuable. We have one family that's moving to a new members class, Lord willing, in a couple weeks. Had a family visit with them last week. And they said, you know, and by the way, I should just say they're not, you know, they didn't grow up in the church. They grew up in nominal families. They asked if I would marry them, and I married them, and they've been coming to the church ever since. They said, you know, the reason that we're in your church is because we think people love us. And they really probably, after a year of somewhat faithful attendance, they probably still don't even know what kind of a church we are. And it's not because we hide that. It's just because they've never even thought in these categories. But they said, we feel loved in your church. And we feel, you know, they actually mentioned that, you know, the first Sunday we came, and Charlie met us on the sidewalk, and he gave us a handshake. He looked in our eyes, and he said, we're so glad you're here today. And it's not an accident that you're here. And they said they still remember that a year later. That was a huge thing for them. You know, we just, as I think Paul said, we cannot imagine how horrifying it is to come into a church for the first time. And we just can't imagine that. We've lost what that feels like, if we've ever felt it at all. Members should be ready to sit next to visitors. And this is not just enough for us to know this. We've got to communicate this to our folks. You know, if someone comes in, they don't know they need a bulletin. They don't know what to do. Just sit by them, you know, or ask them, would you like to sit by us? And you're going to have to readjust your assigned seating, I realize. But you should be willing to do so. We need to make these concessions to love these strangers. You also want to make sure that no guest leaves without being invited for a meal. Now, we don't want to just talk about hospitality. We want to have them over. They're just then and there. If that doesn't work, make plans, but make sure they're specific plans. I'll skip intelligible worship. Paul's already talked about that, just giving explanations and so forth. Beautiful worship. This is a huge subject, but let me just lay down as a fact that most people that come into your churches are expecting something different than what they're getting musically, right? Most people are expecting something really well done, really professional. And by mentioning that, it doesn't mean that we have to adopt their paradigm for what worship music should be like, but it should be beautiful. It should be well done. It should be singable, especially the first song in the worship service. Make sure that you don't pick a clunker ever for the first song in worship, preferably not ever, period. But we need to just evaluate the way that outsiders would view worship. We've actually had people say, you know, we love everything else, but the worship, we just don't think you guys do a good job at it. And, you know, we can quibble with that, but that's what people are thinking. Discipleship, let me just say, I think sometimes we think too often in terms of discipleship classes. Classes are important, but if we can encourage our folks to love strangers enough to come alongside them, we could probably eliminate a lot of our discipleship classes. Or at least our folks could augment them tremendously by having personal relationships with people. The last thing I want to mention here in the second point, and I'll close very briefly with the last point, is sort of in connection with hospitality is we want to view visitors as part of our community, part of our church community. And I know there's a little tension here because we obviously don't want to blur the distinction between members and non-members. We think there's an important distinction. And our visitors need to know that. But at the same time, we want them to feel like this is their church, even if they're not members yet. So we want them to think that there's something missing because they're not members. But we've got folks who have not really been in the position where they even could become members. But if you said, what's your church? They'd say Covenant Reformed Church in Carbondale. That's our church. They feel part of that community. So we try to do whatever we can to include them in the community. You know, we've got our church directory is just a 3-ring binder with pictures that, you know, digital pictures that we put in. And we put our visitors in the directory as soon as we think they're not going to be freaked out by having us ask to take their picture. So someone's come for 2 or 3 weeks. We say, hey, we'd like to include you in our directory. You can include no information, just your name and picture if you want or whatever you want. But we just want you to feel welcome here. So we also, we have a guest and member family photo board in the back of the church where, again, we take our guest pictures as soon as they feel comfortable, put them on the board with their name so that our folks can put the face with a name and try to be more hospitable toward them. Encourage your congregants to get to know guests as early as possible and just stress this. And I think for whatever reason people come to a church, you know, non-churched and non-believing people often will stay because of the community. And we know that that's not the ultimate reason they should stay. But we want to be helpful to them in that respect. I think sort of what I'm trying to present here is sort of a cumulative approach to outreach. To have this structure that has a lot of different bones that you can add the flesh to, but we want to have a cumulative approach. One man who became a member of our church said, you know, you just wore me out with your outreach. And so I came to your church. I just got inundated by all these different things. He picked up a CD at Panera Bread that we'd left. He got our proclamation mailer that someone else had given his address for. He heard our sermon on the radio station. He said, finally, you just wore me out. And I said, I guess I'm going to go check out Covenant Reformed Church. We sort of inundated him with all these things, and the Lord blessed that. Sure? Okay. All right, last thing, implementing the plan. Just a few things here. First of all, I just want to touch on the role of preaching in terms of implementing the plan. And just want to be clear, what I don't mean is what happens every time my wife and I go to my in-law's church in Southern California, which is an RCA congregation, and every single sermon is a promotion of some outreach event. And that's definitely not what we're trying to do here. But if some aspects of the life of the church can't find their way into a sermon, it seems like we might be coming short of sort of implementing and motivating people to serve outside of the church. So I think preaching can play a role in helping us to implement our outreach plan. If for no other way than to help our members sort of face their roadblocks to outreach. And I'll just list a few, but we've got fear, complacency, stinginess, busyness, selfishness, disobedience. You know, all of these things, again, not that we harp on these things, but we want to help people to overcome the roadblocks. Because a lot of people want to glorify God in our churches. They want to reach out to the community, but they have these very real roadblocks. You know, they're scared to death to go with the pastor to talk to unbelievers. But we just help them through that. You know, everything you do for the first time is scary, at least a lot of things. So with God's help, you know, we develop a habit and a pattern. So anyway, you'll have to work that out, but I think preaching can play a role in helping our folks reach out to the community. The role of prayer has been touched on. Pray for outreach opportunities. Pray for those whom you've had contact with. Pray that the Lord would help you value the gospel in your own life, as we've heard as well. There's also, I think, the role of promotion in terms of implementing the plan. Probably not in preaching here, but we need to communicate to the congregation our opportunities that we're hoping to create for them. We also, I think, want to promote the outreach that members are doing. We have, before we enter into our service, in the second service, we have a time of announcements and sort of some sharing. We just want to encourage people to share. You know, have you been able to communicate the gospel this week? And sometimes people won't say anything, but sometimes someone will. You know, one of our members had a very long discussion with some Jehovah's Witnesses at his place, and he shared that, and it was encouraging. Because I think our folks a lot of times think that outreach or evangelism is just something the pastor talks about, but it's not actually happening. If it is happening, it's the pastor who's doing it. And having them understand that people are engaging in outreach can be encouraging. And I think we also want to promote the results of outreach. So during this announcement time, I'll share with the congregation some positive, encouraging results. So, you know, and sometimes the folks in our congregation will do this. You know, someone from our church works at a gas station, and he shared with our congregation, he said one time, someone just covered with tattoos and piercings came into the station, and guy, you know, kind of guy that kind of makes you nervous just having him walk by you, he said. And he walks up to our sermon display and takes a couple CDs and walks out. And, you know, just having Jonathan share that with the congregation was encouraging. And it made them feel like, you know, God is perhaps using what we're doing. Someone who's received our literature sent back a note and said this: "These books have revealed to me a God who is so much grander, more awesome, and much more magnificent than I ever thought possible. Reformation theology has opened my eyes so much more and has answered so many of my questions. Praise the Lord," he said. So just sharing that with the congregation is encouraging to them, knowing that God is using this. And then lastly, preparing or sort of implementing through practice. You know, many of us grew up never doing or even seeing outreach. And so we need to make sure that we're spearheading these efforts. Pastor, elders, deacons, that we're actually modeling to the people what we're talking about. We're practicing what we preach. We're setting an example. We need to implement, of course, though, right, brothers? We can't just see the need for a plan. We can't just develop a plan. We actually have to act. We have to implement. And I gave an allusion to how silly it would be to enter into war without an attack plan. And that just reminds me of that general, George McClellan, that general of the Army of the Potomac, right, who had the most well-trained soldiers in the world. You know, he drilled and practiced and strategized and planned and marched and practiced and drilled and strategized and planned, and he just never acted. Never, and plenty of opportunities to defeat his opponent, and never did. And, you know, we can't adopt that plan. And yet, it seems like sometimes that's our plan. We have some of the best trained theologians in our churches that our communities will ever see. I mean, your church is probably filled with incredible theologians from 5 years old to 90 years old. And we're practiced, in a sense. We're ready. We just need to develop a plan that with God's help we can implement and that God can bless. And so that's my charge and encouragement for you. And be happy to interact with any questions or comments if the good chairman would allow that. Okay.
Do you want to do that now? Or would you
wait till the panel discussion? Why don't we do that?
Take a break and come back.
Good idea. Yep.